Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. We're opening today with the CEO of LifeBridge Community Services, serving the greater Bridgeport region, partnering with individuals, youth, and families to improve well-being, strengthen resilience, and create a brighter future. They've got an exciting event coming up called Creating from the Heart, and we'll invite you to that as well as help you learn about the agency's recent designation as an urban trauma center. Then we're going to welcome a panel of individuals putting the power of two wheels behind a drive to create legislation that's going to greatly help improve the lives, health, and mobility of the thousands of folks across Connecticut who either temporarily or permanently depend on wheelchairs to get around. Then you've already heard about the increasing level of PFAS and forever chemicals in our environment, and especially in our water supply. So we're going to turn to an expert on the subject to learn specifically what the Aquarion Water Company is doing to better identify and filter these potentially harmful chemicals from their numerous state water systems. We'll be back with these and other segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. Speaking of PFAS, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency of New England wants you to weigh in during a virtual listening session for communities across Connecticut to learn about and share feedback on the EPA's PFAS strategic roadmap. That is coming up on Zoom on April 11th, and the public is invited to attend and to speak. This engagement session is going to provide information about EPA's ongoing work under the PFAS strategic roadmap and what it means for New England citizens. To learn more or get registered to listen in or offer your input, just go to PFASCommunityEngagement.org. Well, you know, when an organization has been around for almost 175 years, they got to be doing something right. As a matter of fact, they got to be doing a lot right. And LifeBridge Community Services, as it is known today, is one of those organizations partnering with individuals, youth, and families to improve well-being, to strengthen resilience, and create a brighter future for everybody involved, as well as their communities. And their relatively new CEO is Edith Boyle. She's joined us today to talk about a few important things that are going on at that agency. But before we dig into that, Edith, if we could just reconnect over what we were discussing before we turned on the microphone. You're relatively new to Connecticut, and we're working with our friends down at AmeriCares down in Lower Fairfield County. And then I guess about a year ago, an opportunity came about for you to really bring it back to kind of more of a hyper-local leadership situation, right?
Yes, that is correct. Absolutely.
So from your perspective, what was the greatest appeal when you came to LifeBridge Community Services to potentially lead the agency?
Sure. You know, I'm a licensed behavioral health clinician myself. I'm a licensed clinical social worker. And so, you know, for me, returning to an agency, who the cornerstone of our work is providing mental health services. And so that was especially appealing to me, especially post-COVID-19. The need is so high, and to be able to meet the need at the community level was really important to me.
So it would certainly take an hour's worth of programming, perhaps over a series of weeks, to really recap all of the things that have happened with the organization that formed about 173, 174 years ago that has now become LifeBridge Community Services. But what are a couple of the historical high points that resonated with you as you learned more about the agency, bringing it into this atmosphere that you arrived in just a little over a year ago?
Sure. So, you know, LifeBridge, we've had a few iterations in terms of names or evolutions through the years. Our name switched from Fairfield Supportive Services, or Family Services of Woodfield, about 8 years ago, to LifeBridge. So our services, you know, have primarily through the years been a variety of social service programs. You know, it was an orphanage many, many years ago, just to tell you how far we've come. But over the past 25 years, the cornerstone of our services has been the provision of behavioral health services, as I was mentioning. So counseling for individuals, youth, and families. We're actually one of the largest providers of mental health services in the greater Bridgeport community. You know, there are definitely other nonprofits providing similar services in this region, but I think what differentiates us is that we recently received designation from the Connecticut Department of Children and Families as an urban trauma center.
So what exactly does that mean?
So we were one of eight sites across the state that received this designation as an urban trauma center. Urban trauma is a framework to identify, reclaim, and heal from structural racism. So an essential aspect of advancing racial equity and racial healing is learning about and addressing the psychological effects of racism. So as an urban trauma center, our clinicians receive specialized training in racial trauma through the Urban Trauma Improvement Center.
So as all of the individuals who have varying feelings about, you know, DIY initiatives and all of the complex issues surrounding it, when you're talking to people and you're telling them about structural racism from a community perspective, what are a couple of the most important things that people really kind of need to know to be able to create a foundation of facts on which to help better build and structure their positions and opinions?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. I would say, you know, again, just sort of taking it back to the emotional and mental effects of racism. You know, I'm less positioned to speak about the specific systemic issues as far as LifeBridge, but I'll tell you that the way we interact with our community and the members of our community really does matter. And, you know, we will either keep perpetuating the system or the, you know, challenges and the concerns that are there with racism, or will help to heal that. And I think understanding the psychological effects of racism and being better positioned to understand the population we serve, you know, recognizing over 80% of Bridgeport are individuals of color, it's really important that we understand lived experience and be able to support our clients and community through that.
Does that infer that members of the community are sought to be, or that you plan to seek them to be, a part of the greater team that helps inform the development and improvements in the urban trauma center model as it exists at LifeBridge?
Yes, I think that's really what the state was envisioning too. The Department of Children and Families, you know, they recognize within the foster care system and with the family service system that there was something missing. And I think this was the missing ingredient. And so they've piloted this, like I was saying, with eight different behavioral health sites across the state. And, you know, we're sort of testing and proving this model and this framework. And then hopefully there will be other sites, including nonprofits, that just want to better understand racism and the effects of racism on our health and our well-being. And then from there, you know, do what they can to support.
So in the year or so that you've been with the agency, there is still a learning curve involved. The greater Bridgeport area, as we both know, is very diverse and complex and has many different groups of people and clubs and organizations and educational institutions. In the year that you've been there, with roots as a clinician, are there a couple of specific issues that you're seeing that are preeminent when you are looking across the population that you serve that you really think should be the entry points to apply the benefits of this urban trauma center and the programs you're developing?
Oh, wow. That's a good question, too. I think that there are quite a few nonprofits in this region, is something I've observed. Mm-hmm. So per capita, there are definitely helpers. There are definitely agencies. People do understand the need and people are trying to respond. I think the system can be a bit disjointed. I actually had somebody point that out to me today, just in regards to the mental health system and the healthcare system, getting people in for treatment and for help. It can be disjointed. And I would say that's somewhat true across the nonprofit sector in general. And so though we all really do try to support one another, and believe me, my nonprofit peers have been fantastic since I've come on board a year ago, just very supportive. But we do try to provide referrals to services across our agencies. But I think that shared understanding of what we're, you know, the population we're serving, and that it goes deeper than the provision of services. But how can we address some of the structural issues and the systemic issues that are present?
So it sounds like some of the heavy lifting that you'd like to do now that you have the designation of an urban trauma center is to utilize the position to bring many agencies together to really simplify and make the intake of individuals who need help most a priority, no matter what agency that individual might be served by?
100%. Very well said. I would absolutely agree with that. Yes.
Very good. Changing direction, you've got some exciting things going on, and certainly we have talked to hundreds, maybe thousands of people over the past 30 years or so on this program about how things like cultural arts benefit and can play a role in a lot more than just the face value of the project or the dance troupe or the theatrical or film presentation that is mm-hmm. in front of you. Talk to me a little bit about how you see the arts figuring into the work of LifeBridge Community Services.
Yeah. So, you know, Bridgeport, something I've learned in my short time here, you know, Bridgeport's really home to hundreds of working artists who really maintain a thriving infrastructure, you know, and so integrating art into our programs and services was a natural and important progression for us. Not only is art a key component of our after-school program, but we also have plans to implement art therapy as one of our offerings within our behavioral health department. Art therapy is one of many treatment modalities. You know, there's a passage by author Elizabeth Alexander in her book, The Trayvon Generation. And if I could read it, it says, "Art and history are the indelibles. They outlive flesh. They offer us a compass or a lantern with which to move through the wilderness and allow us to imagine something different and better." So that idea that art is a compass and a lantern, and I would say that's especially true for adolescents who, you know, they have a difficult time sometimes expressing themselves verbally. And in some cases, you know, their problems are too painful or complicated to articulate, to put into words. So this is a type of art therapy is a type of expressive therapy and creative expression, right, to provide them with a safe outlet for expressing their thoughts and emotions. And so we are really looking forward to implementing that as part of our programming. I'll also just say, because this is such an attractive type of therapy for children and adolescents, they're going to be more likely to continue to participate in their treatment and stick with it, to stick with that process until problems resolve. So that's an important part of art therapy as well.
So with that in mind, introduce us and remind listeners that they would be welcome to attend this upcoming event, Creating from the Heart.
Yes, we are hosting, again, an event called Creating from the Heart, Cultivating Our Beloved Community. It's an art event on April 27th at the Knowlton in Bridgeport. And it's intended to bring the Bridgeport community together and surrounding communities together around the healing of urban and racial trauma through artistic self-expression. We have leading industry experts on racial trauma who will be speaking. We also we're going to feature Bridgeport-based artists and some of the artwork produced by our students participating in our after-school program. And attendees will get to hear from our incredible keynote speaker, Say Adams. He's the founding creative director of Def Jam Records. So he's going to share his journey as an artist. The event is open to all ages, and it's completely free to the community. I will say I want to thank our lead sponsor, M&T Bank. So anyone who's interested in attending, you don't necessarily have to register, but we appreciate just to sort of keep a head count if you don't mind registering on our website at lifebridgect.org. But yeah, we're very, very excited about the event.
Really exciting things happening under the new leader and CEO at LifeBridge Community Services, Edith Boyle. LifeBridge, as you have gathered by listening to what we're talking about, is an organization that has been around for almost 175 years in one shape or form in the greater Bridgeport area. And today, as you've heard, they're working hard, partnering with individuals, youth, and families to improve well-being, strengthen resilience, and create a brighter future. We hope that you will be interested in attending Creating from the Heart on April 27th at the Knowlton, and learning more about the great work they're doing, whether you live in the greater Bridgeport area or beyond, because perhaps they can share a template with you for your community. Once again, if you'd like to learn more or register to attend Creating from the Heart, go to lifebridgect.org. And for now, we'll say farewell to Edith Boyle, their CEO at LifeBridge Community Services. Edith, great to meet you. And I look forward to talking to you again. Thanks. I look forward to talking to you again. Well, a long time ago in a radio group far, far away, I was much more engaged with folks working in the greater Hartford and central and northern Connecticut region. So it's great to be reunited with some of my friends from New Horizons and New Horizons Village. Carol Fitzgerald and Marissa McDougall are on the line with us, along with a new friend, Ruth Groey. From CC Equals A, the Citizens Coalition for Equal Access, a local advocacy group for people with disabilities, which has been around now quite some time. Ruth, excuse me, is it Grobe or Groby?
Groby.
Ruth Groby. Very good. So we thank you all for coming on. And as we said in the introduction, there are thousands of people across the state of Connecticut who either for some large portion, or if not their entire lives, depend on wheelchairs for mobility, and still thousands, if not tens of thousands of others who may need to utilize a wheelchair at some point or points in their lives. So it was with great interest that you helped me learn about a piece of legislation that may or may not still be active as we broadcast this program here in April. It is HB 6702. And as you schooled me, the big problem that revolves around huge delays in the maintenance of wheelchairs is causing issues, serious problems in both the private and public sectors. So since this is such a widespread concern, and it is definitely something that is not going to go away, no matter what the status of the pending legislation is, we wanted to bring the three of you on to talk more about it. So let's start with Carol Fitzgerald. She's CEO of New Horizons. Carol, can you just briefly let us know how long you've been engaged with that organization, and then talk a little bit about what you're seeing on the ground that makes you a passionate supporter of this initiative?
Sure. Thank you, John. New Horizons Village is home to 101 adults with physical disabilities. I've been here for about 8 years. Our community provides accessible housing with support services. So independent living is what we strive for. Greater than 90% of our tenants rely on wheelchairs for mobility. But unfortunately, time and time again, we see the challenges that our residents face when they need a wheelchair repair. It's not unusual for them to wait weeks and months. And so we see here that the challenges are real, and we hope that there could be a reasonable solution as soon as possible.
So as wheelchairs have developed over the decades, they've evolved into extremely complex pieces of machinery. And I know Ruth Groby will attest to this, Ruth. Even what may be described as the lesser or least expensive and most simple wheelchairs require some degree of expertise for even some of the most simple adjustments or repairs, right?
Yeah, I believe so.
So what from your perspective with the Citizens Coalition for Equal Access has been driving the legislation that you're proposing take effect across Connecticut?
Well, yeah, the Citizens Coalition for Equal Access, our mission is to remove physical and social barriers. And the physical barrier of not being able to use your wheelchair when that is the piece of equipment that gets you around and allows you to fully participate in life has been a huge issue, and it has been getting more and more difficult to get timely repairs over the past few years as the services, they're limited to two large wheelchair companies. So there is less opportunity to get the repairs quickly from a local vendor.
Oh, I understand. Now, Marissa, you're a resident at New Horizons Village and on the board. Do you utilize a wheelchair in any capacity?
Yes, I do. Over the last, I want to say since 2020 or maybe even 2021, mm-hmm. I have started to use a electric-powered wheelchair to get around mm-hmm. because due to my I suffer from the disability cerebral palsy, and due to my age and certain things happening within my life span, it's just more comfortable for me to use my power chair when I need to. I also still am very grateful that I can also use crutches to walk around when I also need to do that as well, depending upon where I'm going and what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean,
well,
go ahead.
I was going to ask Carol. Carol, when one of the many residents at New Horizons experiences a physical breakage or some type of technological problem with their wheelchair, as Ruth articulated, there's only two vendors to go to. What is the process for getting wheelchairs addressed and repaired in a timely fashion to the extent it can be done?
Well, I think it's very clear that there's limited resources out there. So the tenants here at New Horizons do work very hard to try to get repair services as soon as possible. But as you can imagine, wheelchairs are the legs and cars for many who live here. Mm. And when they cannot get those timely repairs, which we're hearing more and more horror stories, they literally can be limited to their apartment, even in some cases to their beds, certainly aren't able to even enjoy the community, our own community here, let alone outside, things that we take for granted, such as stores and religious services and things like that. It really impacts what we're seeing, many of the tenants, in a way that most of us would not even begin to imagine.
And I'm gathering, and anyone can weigh in on this, for many people, these wheelchairs are somewhat customized to them for maximum safety and comfort. So it's not just a matter of somebody wakes up one morning and their wheelchair isn't functioning, or they go to flip a switch or manipulate something mechanical on it and it breaks. It's not as simple as just providing a loaner or a substitute chair, right?
No, yes, you're absolutely correct, because when I got fitted for my power chair, probably 2 to 3 years by now, I had to go through a specific process of going to my doctor first to have him evaluate me for a power chair, and then I had to go actually get evaluated for the power chair, and then the power chair, that, you know, they had to do certain things, so it was modified to fit me as a person and have the features that I need to be able to, you know, use it and still go on about the daily activities of my normal life.
Mm. And Ruth, do you advocate for folks who utilize wheelchairs, or do you use one yourself?
I advocate for folks. I myself do not have a disability. And one of the reasons I'm involved in this advocacy work is that for a number of years, most of my adult life, I did not know anybody with a disability, and I thought the ADA had taken care of everything. I was totally unaware of the many obstacles and barriers that are faced every day by people with physical disabilities. So that's one of the reasons I'm quite passionate as an advocate. And I would say, in terms of, there are a lot of problems with wheelchair repair at the moment that are exacerbated by the process, by the fact that there is highly technical at this point. But there's also an attitudinal problem of ease in just even responding to come out and look at the person's wheelchair, delays. You can leave a message. It's very hard to get hold of an actual person these days when you call in for a repair. You can wait days to have somebody come out to even look at what the technical problem is. And then the two big wheelchair repair companies do not stock parts. So if some part is required, that takes another whole long time of ordering it and getting it to come. And then finally, there's also a bureaucratic process of having to get prior authorization from either a private insurance company or from Medicaid or Medicare in order for the repair to be done. So there are sort of complicated barriers all along the way, and the legislation was an attempt to address some of those.
Well, let's take a quick break and come back and talk more specifically about the legislation, which may or may not survive the current session, but you all certainly will continue to keep on the front burner in front of lawmakers here locally. We're working with Carol Fitzgerald, who is CEO of New Horizons Incorporated. A resident and board member of New Horizons Village, Marissa McDougall, as well as Ruth Groby, who's with the Citizens Coalition for Equal Access. We'll be back in just a second. Stick with us. Hey, do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one, or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Say, if you're the parent or guardian of a young person in central or western Connecticut, listen up. The Northwest Regional Workforce Investment Board is hosting a youth health and wellness fair April 12th at the Waterbury PAL on Division Street. The event is designed to promote healthy lifestyles among young people and will offer a variety of activities, resources, raffles, and educational opportunities. Attendees can participate in informational sessions on nutrition, exercise, exercise, mental health, and career explorations. If you'd like more information about the Youth Health and Wellness Fair, just call 203-574-6971 or visit nrwib.org for the Northwest Regional Workforce Investment Board. We also want you to know that area 4th through 8th graders are invited to participate in a hackathon for social good with Connecticut-based nonprofit Random Hacks of Kindness Jr. You've heard about them here on the award-winning For the People. That event's coming up Sunday, April 30th from 9 to 2 at the Steers Center at Canterbury School in New Milford. The goal of the hackathon is to introduce students to technology and to show them how it can be used to create solutions that benefit nonprofit organizations. This event requires no prior coding knowledge. Using Code.org's App Lab, students are going to learn the basics of app design as well as the ideation and brainstorming process required to build a successful prototype mobile application. Pre-registration is required, so if you'd like more information and to register, just visit the Random Hacks of Kindness Jr. website, rhokjr.org. We're back with Carol Fitzgerald, CEO of New Horizons, one of the residents and board members of New Horizons Village, Marissa McDougall, as well as Ruth Grobisch, who is a representative of the Citizens Coalition for Equal Access, CC equals A. We're talking about some of the challenges that have prompted these individuals to try to introduce a legislative bill in the Connecticut State House to address some of the frustrations and challenges that you've heard about in the earlier segment of the show. So I know, Marissa, you were wanting to talk a little bit about what your hopes are in regards to this bill. Can you just kind of give us a brief explanation of what would happen if the bill as proposed was enacted?
Yeah. Well, first I wanted to bring up in your earlier segment an experience I had with trying to obtain a wheelchair repair where it did take quite a bit of time from the time I called the company for them to come out and then look at the issue with my chair, you know, because I had to have somebody come out and look at it, and then it seemed to actually get the part. It seemed to take a brief bit of time, but I'm also hoping with the legislation as it currently stands that we have just more of a response from the two major wheelchair companies, you know, in a better time frame, because like Carol has said and Ruth has said, you know, you call these companies right after the issue happens with your chair, and it takes them sometimes quite a few days to get back to you. And then sometimes you have to then speak to a remote technician and have them look at your chair via video. And then you also end up then saying to them, you know, this really needs to have a technician come out to look at it. And then it takes time to order the part. And it can be anywhere from, you know, a short period of time to 2 weeks to sometimes, depending upon what the issue is, 6 months for them to finally address the repair issue with your chair.
In your case, it undoubtedly makes you so much more appreciate the chair than the crutches, right?
Yes. I mean, I had an issue last winter where a couple of winters ago, where I was out and about with my chair and a front caster popped off. And it's January and it's cold and it's dark. And I had no choice but for a period of time to use my crutches because that was the only thing that was available to me.
Well, it's certainly...
And it's different. Yeah.
Sorry.
And it's different because... I'm sorry, I don't mean to keep cutting you off. It's different because, you know, I have to be, you know, more... When I use my crutches, I have to be obviously more conscious of my surroundings, but I also have to be conscious of myself physically because, unfortunately, I'm not as young as I once was, and I hate... Maybe this isn't a good thing to say, but as I'm getting older now, I'm relying more on my chair.
Sure.
You know, and we don't, people, the able-bodied world doesn't realize that our chairs are an extension of who we are.
Right. And that's what they're there for.
Yeah. Right. And if we don't have them, then we can't live our life to the fullest.
Right. Carol Fitzgerald, CEO of New Horizons, is part of the panel. Carol, as you interact with other leaders of organizations like New Horizons across the state of Connecticut, do you find that there's both consensus around and energy behind driving some sort of legislation like the piece that was proposed this year?
I think it's a common theme that we're hearing across the state, certainly. From my perspective, I'm hoping for an awareness at a minimum that creates action on the part of the vendors and the legislatures to solve this problem one way or another. Our tenants have affected change in the past with regards to accessibility, I'm so proud to say. Mm. And I'm certain that they'll be persistent on this issue as well. So it's not going to go away. The voices need to be heard, because how can one live an independent, self-directed life without the ability to get from one place to another?
Yeah. Well, we'll leave the last word up to Ruth Groby, who, as we mentioned, represents the Citizens Coalition for Equal Access, who were a main driver behind the proposed legislation, which still may see the light of day before the end of this session. But if it doesn't, we'll certainly be coming back in a big way in 2024. Ruth, we've got about a minute. If you just like to make a final statement to the folks who are listening, who may be able to join a much bigger coalition to get behind legislation of this nature, what would you tell them?
Well, I would like to say, as an able person, that I've seen a lot of my fellow Americans kind of comfortable with keeping people with disabilities at arm's length and even sort of invisible the way it was for me for many, many years. And I think it's because people with disabilities may remind us of our human vulnerability, and the fact that any one of us could end up in a wheelchair at any point. But that's the very reason we all need to be interested in this issue, because actually you can be in a wheelchair and live a full life and live out your dreams and develop as a person, but you need this. All of us could do that if we at some point had to use a wheelchair, but we need the society to provide the supports that will allow that to happen. And for some people, wheelchairs, if you don't have your wheelchair, you end up lying in bed. It's very important.
Well, certainly the detriments of that are a conversation for another day, but I thank you for your very astute and appropriate closing comments. Ruth Groby represents the Citizens Coalition for Equal Access. She's joined by Marissa McDougall, a resident and board member at New Horizons Village, and our friend Carol Fitzgerald, CEO of New Horizons. Folks, if you speak to your state lawmaker, just let them know that the wheelchair bill that is in front of them or will be again next year is important to you as a voter, and try to provide the necessary support to the thousands and tens of thousands of Connecticut residents who may be permanently or temporarily in need of using and repairing a wheelchair. Thank you, folks, for being on the program today. Well, I'm really excited to return to the subject of forever chemicals here. Folks who are regular listeners may recall a fairly complex science lesson that we had a few months ago with a scientist who was on the program talking about PSAs and forever chemicals here in Connecticut. And certainly this is a growing concern and a growing threat. Everybody's looking at it, from legislators to scientists to individuals who represent utilities agencies that handle water, and one of them are with us. John Walsh is Vice President of Operations and Utility Innovation at Aquarian Water Company. They serve many communities within our listening area and beyond, and we're going to pick up the conversation, hopefully keep it a little bit more on the consumable level for folks, whether you're listening early on the Sunday morning to the show on the air, or you've picked up the podcast at some point later. We appreciate you coming on, John. Certainly a concerning subject. But first, let's talk a little bit about Aquarian and your role in it and the towns you serve and things like that.
Okay, great, John. Well, thank you very much for having me on your show this morning. I'm the Vice President of Operations and Utility Innovation for Aquarian. And one aspect of the business that I'm responsible for is our water quality. And most importantly, that's ensuring that the water we provide to customers meets all state and federal regulations. And Aquarian, for those of you who don't know us, we're the public water supply company for residents in 72 cities and towns in Connecticut, Massachusetts, and New Hampshire. In Connecticut alone, we serve a population of more than 700,000 people in 59 cities and towns. Our largest service areas are in the southwestern part of Connecticut, from Greater Bridgeport down to Greenwich. We also have many small and medium-sized service areas throughout the rest of the state. Important for the discussion about PFAS is that we obtain our water from many different wells and reservoirs throughout the state. We have nearly 300 wells and 8 reservoir systems in the state.
Good. So, you know, am I actually saying it wrong when I'm saying PFAS? You actually say it PFAS. And so when we're talking about it, that's the way I would be describing it for people who are more in the know about it.
Yeah, in the industry, people refer to them as PFAS.
Okay, very good. So certainly people are hearing about this, and there are some concerns, even though they may not understand the complex chemical and chemistry elements of it. So kind of in more layman's terms, what are PFAS and what do they have to do with the water that we're drinking?
PFAS, first of all, it's an acronym for per and polyfluoroalkyl substances. They're a family of over 5,000 man-made chemicals with properties that include the ability to repel water, prevent staining, and increase heat resistance. Because of these properties, since the 1940s, they've been used in many industrial and consumer applications, including the coating of fabrics, carpets, electrical wire, nonstick cookware, and food packaging, and also in firefighting foam. So they're widely used and they're long lasting. In other words, they don't biodegrade quickly in the environment. And because of this, PFAS are found in the air, soil, and in water, including both groundwaters and surface waters like reservoirs. And unfortunately, studies have shown that exposure to some PFAS may be linked to harmful health effects in humans and animals.
So I'm gathering the longer period that grows in between the growing proliferation of these chemicals and the ability for science to kind of catch up and do the necessary and responsible type of studies that are needed. This is part of the reason why the concern is growing. There's more and more evidence pointing toward the fact that PFAS are not just proliferating at a greater rate, perhaps exponential rate, in our environment, but the effects of those chemicals are also being found more often to be causing problems.
Yes, exactly. The effects are causing, well, studies have shown they're causing health risks. Also, importantly, the ability to detect them in the environment has improved over the last 7 to 10 years. Mm. Lab techniques have just improved where labs can detect them at lower and lower concentrations. So in the past, the lab would test for a PFAS compound and not find it. So they would report that it was non-detect, but it was simply because the lab did not have the ability to detect down to a low enough concentration. So that's why it's being found more and more.
Okay.
In the environment.
And not to go off script, but I think it's important to clarify, a lot of times when people are kind of casually, you know, in the news or whatever, hearing about PFAS, they're also being kind of lumped into the same kind of sentence as forever chemicals. So PFAS are a family of chemicals who are forever chemicals, but they are not all the forever chemicals, right?
You know, of course, I've heard the term forever chemicals, and I think that does specifically refer to PFAS when people are using that term.
Oh, okay. So it's somewhat of an interchangeable definition.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Very good. So then explain to our listeners about what's going on at the EPA level now, because it sounds like as science is becoming more acutely able to detect, trace, and determine the outcomes of exposure, the EPA is ramping up some initiative.
Yes, yeah, that's the case. A few weeks ago, the US EPA proposed the National Drinking Water Standard for 6 PFAS. And this regulation proposes limits on the concentration of these 6 PFAS in drinking water. So why this is becoming bigger news is for a couple of reasons. First of all, the regulation applies nationwide. There are some states that already have PFAS regulations, but those regulations only apply to that particular state. And note that Connecticut is not one of the states that has a PFAS regulation. Also, the regulation from EPA will be enforceable. And that's in contrast to what I'll refer to as guidance limits that have been set by the federal and Connecticut state regulators in recent years. Utilities were not required to comply with those guidance levels. And the third reason it's becoming bigger news is that the PFAS concentration limits proposed in the regulation are relatively low. And to meet those low limits, water utilities are going to have to invest in infrastructure, especially water treatment facilities, to remove the PFAS from the water.
So in Connecticut, that means not just Aquarion Water Company, but all the water companies that are serving anyone in the state in a public utility capacity.
Yes, exactly. This regulation is applicable to all public water suppliers, and the data, we don't have the data for the other utilities, our neighboring utilities.
Sure.
But the expectation is that many utilities are going to detect PFAS over the proposed limits from EPA.
Okay. So while you folks who are listening may not get their water bill or their water supply from Aquarion, the application of the federal guidelines statewide will bring the water company that is involved with delivery to your home or business will be equally impacted. But speaking for Aquarion, who delivers such a significant amount of water in our greater listening area, John Walsh, what is your company doing about PFAS in drinking water?
We'll be doing a number of things. For our Connecticut operations, we've been voluntarily testing for PFAS since 2019 across all of our wells and reservoirs, and we're going to continue doing that in 2023. And we're also sharing this data on our website. We've been doing that for a number of years. In the past year, we took action to reduce the PFAS at some of our wells. These well waters have PFAS in concentrations above the guidance levels defined by the Connecticut regulator. And for these wells, we're being proactive in following the guidance from our state regulator. Go ahead. You had a question.
No, I was going to say, does this entail you having to retool or
more rebuild or start from scratch in terms of the facility required to do this screening and removal?
For these specific wells, one of them we're installing treatment, and three of them, what we're doing is we're going to take the well offline, and we're proposing to install a water main connecting the system served by that well to one of our other neighboring systems that has well or wells without PFAS in them. So that is, those are the two most prevalent solutions to this issue. One is to treat the water to remove the PFAS, and the other is to interconnect the system so that you can take a well or wells with PFAS offline.
Okay. Are there long-term plans for Aquarion, at least, for additional treatment facilities?
Yeah, we do expect that we're going to have to, with the new proposed regulation from EPA, we've looked at all this data we've been collecting since 2019, and we can see that a number of our facilities are going to need treatment or close enough to the limits proposed by EPA that will provide treatment.
Okay. Well, as is often the case in state or federal mandates, especially ones that are designed to, mitigate issues that impact public health or that could improve public health, sometimes there's also a companion funding available to cover the cost of things like rerouting and redoing the lines or creating these facilities. Is that the case with the PFAS mitigation, and has Aquarion pursued any of that funding?
Yes, that the federal government, through the bipartisan infrastructure law, is providing billions of dollars nationwide to invest in drinking water systems impacted by PFAS and other emerging contaminants. About $25 million of that is being allocated to Connecticut. And we have already applied for some of that financing for these projects that we started in 2022. And we'll actually know in May if we've been approved for that financing. What this financing involves is low-interest loans that will also have a principal forgiveness component. And that will help defray the cost of these projects, which will help mitigate the impact on our water rates.
Okay. So as you mentioned early on in the conversation, John, these PFAS or so-called forever chemicals are being found, as you said, in both groundwater and surface water in the wells that Aquarion operates, as well as others. Certainly, I have concern that private wells for the thousands and thousands of individuals across Connecticut that have them may also have some concentration of PFAS, certainly above the level of the new EPA standards. Is there anything that the end-use consumer could do, whether they're on an Aquarion line, another water company's line, or on a private well? Any types of devices or filters or anything that could be done in the home or the business to help filter out or mitigate these dangerous chemicals?
Well, I will say for residents who have their own private well, I'd recommend they go to the Connecticut Department of Public Health website. They do have a frequently asked questions that give some guidance to people with private wells.
Mm-hmm.
I think for our customers, there are point of use devices, filtration units that have granular activated carbon in them that people can use. I think it's important to recognize, though, that PFAS regulations or limits are generally based on lifetime exposure, so really long-term exposure.
Mm-hmm.
So that is how EPA sets their limits. So for our part, we're proactive and we will continue to be to stay ahead of this issue and make sure that we're in compliance with the state regulations or guidelines and also the EPA's regulations. But if customers want to know more about health impacts of a PFAS, I would recommend that they refer to the US EPA or Connecticut Department of Public Health websites. Okay. For information. They've put up some pretty good information about this topic.
Great. And to bring the conversation to a close for today, John, what is Aquarian offering in terms of resources for customers to get to know this subject more, understand it, and know on almost kind of like in real time how Aquarian is addressing it?
Sure. Well, on our website, as I mentioned, we have our PFAS data. So all of our PFAS data for the past several years, also information about what we're doing to address the issue in some of our systems. That is at aquarianwater.com/PFAS. You can also find information about PFAS in our annual consumer confidence reports. They're also known as water quality reports, and they are also on our website.
Very good. A decidedly more consumable and conversational chat this morning about PFAS or so-called forever chemicals in terms of specifically what Aquarian Water Company is doing about it here in our listening area and for communities they serve across Connecticut. John Walsh has been the voice representing Aquarian this morning. He is the Vice President of Operations and Utility Innovation. And John, I really appreciate all the great information that you're able to bring us this morning. Thank you so much for the latest information on PFAS. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program for the people. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.